Welcome to Talent Hub Talk. I'm Ben Duncombe, and on this podcast, I will be interviewing prominent and inspirational figures from both the local ANZ and global Salesforce Ohana. In today's episode, I'm joined by Brooks Johnson. Brooks is someone that I wanted to get on the show because he proves that you can become a Salesforce developer without coming from a technical background. So I wanted to chat to Brooks and hear more about his experience. And through the episode, we discuss life before Salesforce and what he kind of did for many years in the military, what he wanted to do when he was leaving the military or what he was preparing to do when he left the military for a new career. And then where the idea of Salesforce came from and what first attracted him to the platform. We discuss what understanding of development and coding he had before he discovered the Salesforce platform and why the developer career path appealed to him, which was interesting to get his view on that. We look at how he started learning to code and the biggest challenges that he faced in the early days and whether or not coding was actually something that he took to quickly or if it took him time to really get his head around. We then discuss if, in Brooks' opinion, anyone can learn to code and some of the platforms and areas that Brooks went to learn to code and some of the other tools that he advises people look into or platforms that people can use to upskill in the coding space. We discuss career opportunities that Brooks has come across since he moved into the Salesforce ecosystem, why he feels it's important for Salesforce developers to know more than just Salesforce, and then discuss some of the videos and content that he puts out to help people on their Salesforce journey. So yeah, really interesting guy, someone that I think a lot of people can take inspiration from if they are looking to go down the coding path. And I highly recommend checking out his videos on YouTube, which you can find by following him on LinkedIn because he posts them all there. So yeah, really inspirational guy, someone that I think we can all learn from about pivoting and learning new skills. And hopefully you enjoy the episode. And if you do, please do subscribe for future episodes that are coming through. Cool. Well, Brooks, thank you so much for joining us. I'm excited to hear more about your story today, and I've got a lot to run through with you. I always like to start looking before Salesforce and going way back, and you definitely have an interesting background. So let's discuss that a little bit. What was life like before Salesforce for you?
So sure. And I just thanks for having me on. I'm a big fan of your podcast. So it's really exciting to be here.
Thank you.
Life before, well, so for folks that are, I guess, why would you know, right? I was in the Army for 21 years on active duty, U.S. Army total. I was in the reserves and things for a while. So, but pretty much my entire adult life until 44, 45, I was in the military. And U.S. military careers have about a 20-year shelf life. You know, at that point, you become eligible for some of the retirement things. And generally, it's time to move on. So I preface this by saying, in no way did I have a technical background. I spent my career split between infantry, which is the least technical thing you could possibly do, probably, and then recruiting, which I really, really hated. I joke when I talk to recruiters, right? Like, that's all I knew when I left the Army is I didn't want to be a recruiter anymore. Like, anything else would be awesome. And so, yeah, then I left the Army, and I'm going to say, kind of through a series of pivots and following opportunity, I ended up in the Salesforce industry. But truth be told, I'm turning my head to read my retirement certificate. Okay, so June 2016, that's the date on it. In June 2016, I did not know what Salesforce was. I had never heard of it. I don't think I knew what a CRM was.
What did you use in your recruitment days then? What were you tracking?
So I, so it was a proprietary Army system. Although oddly, I believe Army recruiting is moving to Salesforce. I could be wrong on that.
Yeah.
But I think military, maybe, or some part of U.S. military recruiting is moving to Salesforce anyway. But we just had a proprietary Army applicant tracking system.
Sure. It's interesting because I've recorded a podcast or a LinkedIn Live, I think, with Roger Miranda, another ex-military guy. And he spoke about recruiters having a bad rap in the industry because I can't remember exactly what he said, but there was like a term that was used. And I think it's like they overpromise and underdeliver ultimately. I think they tell you what you want to hear.
Nobody's got a worse reputation than military recruiters, I think. So,
really?
At least in the U.S. anyway, where it's all volunteer and big quotas to hit. It was a tough racket.
Yeah, I can imagine. So obviously, you mentioned there's kind of a period of time. You've got about 20 years in the military, and then you know that you're going to be leaving. So what did you initially think you would go on to do? Like, what were the options?
The reason I'm laughing is because now looking back, right, 4 years later, 4.5 years, I guess now, it was so stereotypical. So I feel like people tell veterans, at least I realize a lot of, the audience will be not in the U.S., so at least in America, oh, you're going to be a project manager, right? Like, you've been a project manager for 20 years, so you're going to kill it. Like, everybody's going to want to hire you, one, for your awesome leadership skills and for your project management ability. So that was kind of first, like, oh, well, I'll go, I guess I'll be a project manager. And I got my PMP even, and like, did me like open zero doors for me. Like, and then maybe other people are different, but I tell people, like, somebody hiring a project manager, like, they're looking for somebody with like this many years in IT or this many years in pharmaceutical and experience with FDA trials. Nobody's just looking for a generic, PM out there. But so I kind of, that was kind of my generic where I was going to go. And I remember, to that point, like, I thought I'd figured it out. Okay, I've solved post-Army life. I'm going to be a project manager. And I talked to some friend, guy had been out for a couple of years, was a good mentor. And he's like, oh, that's great. I was like, what industry? And he was like, the industry with the projects, I know. All that says, I never became a project manager. And honestly, like, having worked in IT now for several years, I can say, thank goodness, like, that just looks like a terrible job to me.
It's interesting because David Scott Nava had the same plan, project manager, when he was leaving the military. So I guess it is a thing, right? That's what people kind of say, go down this path.
We did like the exact same stuff. Like, we got like project manager and like got an MBA. And I don't think any of it really, like, at the time, I thought like people would just like shower jobs and money on me for having those credentials. And, now I really try to encourage people to make it really, these soft skills and these things will make you very successful once you get in the door. But it's really ultimately, it's hard skills that tend to get you hired, So like, I'd love to hire, a veteran that was a awesome, Salesforce developer, but you got to know Apex first, and I can't do that for you.
Sure. So how did Salesforce come on the agenda?
So first job out of the Army, we used Salesforce, and I was in kind of, I'm going to say like a semi-recruiting, semi-sales ops type thing. And we used Salesforce. So that's kind of where I discovered it and started to learn how to work with the platform. But I wasn't really doing too much more than building some dashboards and working with IT and business analysts to configure it for users in the field. So flash forward, say a year, 2017 was the first time somebody I was actually going to school with said, hey, have you heard of like VetForce and Trailhead? And honestly, I had not. I didn't know what any of these things were. So I signed up and I was like, oh, hey, like Trailhead, this seems pretty cool. I didn't even know this was out here. And I just started building it. And VetForce was a great resource for me. Although most of the classes, I think, like when I did my admin and stuff, honestly, I think I just used Udemy and, like Mike Wheeler's fantastic courses on there. And then at that point, it was kind of a good point. So my whole team was, we were going to get laid off. I knew that was coming. But I was honestly kind of okay with it because I was ready to try to, I didn't really love what I was doing. And I thought, okay, instead of having kind of one foot in Salesforce, and like, I'm going to go just try to pivot into this industry. So I moved from there over to, I'm going to call kind of a, it was an admin position, but they were very happy to have an admin that wanted to learn to develop on the platform, which I actually think is a really great starting place for. You're only going to get that, I'm going to say a smaller organization with a reasonably high tolerance for failure. Big enterprises can't have people learning on the job.
Yeah, but was that an end customer or a consulting company?
Consulting.
Okay, cool. So it was like a smaller consulting firm with other Salesforce professionals around you?
No, I was it. So it was a consulting company, but not a Salesforce partner.
Right.
If that makes sense. And they just had one big client where Salesforce was part of the project. And they're like, okay, we're going to hire a Salesforce person for this project. But yeah, I was still like, that was it. I was the Salesforce person. But that was where I, I'm going to say learned to code, right? A lot of early mornings and practicing on the train. But that's, I guess that was my first job and where it all kind of started.
Sure. So when you left the military, would it be fair to say you had no coding experience?
Yeah, I was starting to get interested in it. And it still is, but like data scientist was the big thing, right? Like, that's the hot, sexy job. And if you could be a data scientist, you'll make a bazillion dollars a year. And I started to play around with Python and R. And I mean, I never progressed too much past Hello World, but I thought it was cool. But I'd never done serious development, you know, prior to.
So why did the developer, because you mentioned that that company hired you as an admin that had an interest in learning development. Like, what was it that made you interested in being a developer?
So initially, just straight, and I joke, but it was challenging. I liked the challenge. I liked that piece of it. But also, there looked like there was a lot more money. The first time I get somebody's like, I went on Trailhead. And I think at that time, there were three careers, right? There was admin, like BA, and developer. And a salary for each, and the salaries were probably inflated, but I was like, oh wow, look how much the developers make. Like, I guess I'll go do that. And there was the beginning developer trail, I remember. So I started chunking away on this early on, right? You're just like creating, it's because the beginning developer and beginning admin, you know, had pretty significant overlap. So for a lot of you're just going on, I'm like creating custom fields. I'm like, oh man, I got this, right? I can create a field, you know, I can do a pick list. And until you get to that, it was the first, like, write a simple trigger, something, and, like, the wheels just came off. I was like, oh, my God, I have no clue, like, what I am. I mean, looking back, right now, it seems like the most trivial thing in the world. It was, like, you know, a trigger that, like, takes a word and capitalizes it or something. But, yeah, I was just, like, mind blown. No idea what I'm doing. And that was the day I was like, you know what? This is maybe going to take a little bit longer than I thought to become a developer, because say Trailhead's a great tool, but it's not a good place to learn to code.
So what is a good place to learn to code for you? Like, where did you kind of really start to get to grips with things?
So I think the options are a little different now than they were then. Probably like a lot of people, I discovered, you know, just through Google searches, found David Liu really fast, signed up for his Apex Academy on Pluralsight, which is a fantastic course. But it's, you know, now looking back, I mean, it does teach you the very basics of Apex, but it's not enough to really get you job ready. At that time, I think there wasn't a lot of Apex specific, or not as many as there are now. So I also spent, you know, and I think David actually talks about this in his videos, but studying Java, because, you know, Apex and Java, at least syntactically and through a lot of the concepts, are very similar. So I found some really fantastic Java courses on Udemy. Team Treehouse is another resource I'm a big fan of. I still use it. And, you know, I would start playing with Java, and then I would try to, you know, recreate those concepts in a developer org. And, you know, I mean, said, I think a big part of programming is muscle memory. And I don't know, you do it often enough, eventually it sticks, I guess.
So did you like outside of the Salesforce ecosystem, or even inside mm-hmm. the Salesforce ecosystem, did you have friends that were developers? Like, did you have people to bounce ideas off of, or
No, and I guess I'm laughing because when you ask me these questions, I'm like, this was nuts. What was I even thinking? I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, I would use, I don't know, Stack Exchange and all the other, you know, and I would throw, you know, get a null pointer exception, and I had no idea what that even meant. But no, I was it, right? So one of the reasons I moved on after to the next job was because I felt like I'd gone as far as I could go being like the only Salesforce guy.
Sure.
And the only developer, not just the only Salesforce developer, but like the only developer. So that's why I went, you know, moved on to the next job, was to, you know, have that chance to be part of a team and to work with other programmers.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think it would be really hard not having that network around you, not just because like it's great to ask questions, but I love the idea of if I ever wrote a trigger, the first thing I'd do is run outside and grab my wife and be like, come and look at this trigger I've just built. And she'd be like, so what? But like, actually, actually having someone that understands how cool it is that you've written a piece of code would be amazing. But if you don't have that, I imagine my wife would just walk out the door as soon as I showed her, and like, that would be nothing. But if you had a developer friend, they'd be like, amazing, like, that's great. Did you think of doing it this way, like bouncing ideas together?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. It would have been awesome. But sadly, I did not have that. It was just like, you know, me, like, I don't know, like watching YouTube videos on the train. It's kind of nuts. That's why I went to another job to get more of that experience and the chance to learn from other programmers. But yeah, initially it was joke, like just like me and YouTube, right?
You know? Yeah, yeah. So at what moment was it that you were like, yeah, you said the wheels fell off when you wrote your first trigger, which was, yeah. So at what point did you go, this is what I really want to do?
I think that was a real gradual progression. And I guess when we're talking in terms of just career, are you familiar? There's a book I really recommend to people, Cal Newport's So Good They Can't Ignore You. So I think it's a fantastic career book. But the premise is that that skills trump passion. He's like, because people always tell you pick a career based on your passion. And he's like, well, if that was true, we'd all be travel bloggers and restaurant critics. Right? If everybody's just like, what are you passionate about? And he's like, this is why we can't all be restaurant critics.
Sure.
But it is if you get really good at almost anything, you'll probably become passionate about it. That, passion can follow skills in that sense. And when you would start to look at anybody that, say, had a really, that, just we as a society would say, that person has an awesome job. It tends to be jobs that offer, some level of, obviously a good income, autonomy, some creative freedom, things like that. He's like, well, those jobs are kind of hard to come by. And if you want them, you better have a pretty great set of skills to offer in exchange. But said, if you've developed those skills, you'll probably be very passionate about them because they got you this job. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say, I don't know if there was a moment for me where I was like, oh, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. I think it was just kind of this gradual progression as I learned and got better, and because this continued to open more opportunities for me, that I just became more passionate about what it was that I do.
So did you ever consider not continuing
in development?
Yeah, like as in, did it ever get to a point where you're like, I'm not getting this, I'm just, this isn't for me?
Yeah, like every day. it is hard. Learning to code is hard. And I don't know, maybe you have the rare super genius out there, but most of us are not. And it is a long process of, and it still is to this day, of screwing stuff up, learning from your mistakes, looking things up. And but especially when you're starting off, it's very frustrating because you're just, and I talk about this in one of the YouTube videos that I did, where I try to encourage people, don't let syntax scare you away. Because I think for the first 6 months, that's really hard. It is just knowing, this is how I declare a variable, right? These are the symbols and words I have to put together to make a variable called, name or something, and print that to the screen. But I'm also a big believer that kind of stuff is largely muscle memory. And I think a lot of programming is kind of like a lot of skills, right? There's a lot of repetition and just building it. That after you've been doing this for a while, I say syntax is, I believe, arguably the very least interesting part of it. That's not coding. Being a developer is not about syntax, which is just the language you have to use to make the machine understand your instructions. I mean, you have to know syntax, but it's not what development's all about. It's just the biggest hurdle to overcome.
So can anyone overcome that hurdle? Can anyone learn to code, in your opinion?
I think that's a great question. I thought about that a lot. And, I always say the job market would suggest no, right? I always tell people if it was easy to learn to code, I say the job market would look very different than it does, right? Lots of people would learn to code and the salaries would go down and supply and demand would, always would kick in. So I would say, yes, I think anybody can learn to code, but like anything else in life, there are not everybody. Like I said, I can learn to play golf, but I'm not going to get to be Tiger Woods. And in no way am I the Tiger Woods of Salesforce today at all. I'm average on my best day. So you can learn to code, but you probably won't be Grace Hopper or, Linus Torvald, right? But I think a lot of people get frustrated in those first 6 months. Because if you compare it to learning a language, right? So you do that first kind of hello world stuff and you're like, oh, this is pretty easy. I got it, right? It's like when you took German or Spanish and you learn to say your name on the first day and you're like, this is like until somebody plops you down and Berlin and German started speaking to you or whatever country you're in. You're like, I can't actually do anything useful with the skills I have. It takes a long time. I remember a friend of mine saying, it takes a long time to get to the point where you could sit down and look at a blank screen and make something useful. Like there's a big piece of learning between hello world and the day somebody can hand you a user story and you can go to a blank screen and create, a functional piece of software off of that. But a lot of that to get to that point for most of us, for me certainly, is just perseverance.
Sure. So you came into this ecosystem with a certain set of skills. It might not have been the project manager skills that, I'm sure you do have project management skills, but they weren't the skills that you ultimately then lent on. So what set of skills did you have that you felt or that you now feel set you up for success as a developer?
So as a developer, I'm going to say maybe even just as a career changer, whether, you know, is a, I think there's a lot of soft skills that the military tends to build, especially I'm going to talk about, you know, perseverance, resilience, that kind of, you know, I failed. Good. You know, I'm going to get up, dust myself off and do it again, because that's, you know, changing careers. And that was my experience. Changing careers in the middle of your life isn't easy. So I don't think I really started off with really any of the requisite hard skills, but I like to think that my previous career had given me some of the character traits that helped me just stick with it.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's key, right? Like, mm-hmm. like you said, if you stick with it, it doesn't mean you're going to be the best developer in the world, but you'll get to a certain level. And it's just maintaining that, right? And keeping developing and pushing. So what has the career journey looked like? What's the evolution of your Salesforce career journey look like? So you performing kind of an admin role, then you went in, you were mm-hmm. into a consultancy doing development and administration, and then you went to another place where you broadened that skill set, right? You had other people around you?
Yeah, I did. So I went to a Salesforce partner, great place. So we're a gold partner, and they were kind enough to let me then, I had been working with a particular client for 10 months and I really liked the client, and I'd been there so long, I'd started to feel a real sense of ownership for a lot of the work I had done. So I recently actually just switched over. So now I work for an American medical device company, Insulet, full-time as one of the senior Salesforce developers on their team. But I've been with them really all of 2020. So yeah, I guess that was just kind of that progression to working with a team, and still am. I mean, I think that's, you know, but now like a truly like a large enterprise org, right? With, you know, thousands of users, and I'm not even sure how many Salesforce developers we have right now. We feel like we're hiring so fast.
Sure. And what for you has been the, because you've been working for them for 10 months anyway, but going mm-hmm. from smaller orgs to a bigger org, like what's been the key consideration for you as to how you go about your work?
So with the bigger orgs, is I'm going to say, thank goodness we have a couple people on the team that have been there for a long time that can really, there's a big difference. And I think this is even if you're a computer scientist graduate coming out of college, there is a big difference between, you know, doing a development tutorial on YouTube or your computer science and whatever it is you're doing, to working with any sort of enterprise with, you know, say 10 plus years of legacy code lying around, and you're trying to figure out, like, somebody wrote this 7 years ago, like they're long gone, I can't even figure out what they were trying to do. So it is very useful to have a couple people that you can just talk to about that, like, you know, where in the code base do I even go look to start off for this, because when you start dealing now, you've got hundreds of classes, and then it becomes that's very different. So I guess maybe that gave me an appreciation for the fact that, I say in a lot of ways, what I call like net new development is actually, I think, much easier. A lot of times somebody's like, we just need this brand new greenfield feature. I think every developer loves doing that. It's like, when we need an enhancement to this thing that somebody built 6 years ago, you know, and you're like, oh, right. Like, and then you go in and you're like, I, you know, like you don't like the way it was built, or, you know, like it won't scale properly. And those are all the, I think, the challenges that really come with working with a big, I would say I'd love to finally just get like a big, like greenfield enterprise project, but there's not many of those to be found, right? I always feel like by the time people figure out, I think by the time a lot of customers realize they actually need like good Salesforce professionals, like it's like too late.
Yeah.
You've already made them back.
Well, I'm finding that with my own org at the moment. Like, we're doing a little bit of work on it, and like no one that did the implementation used the description field.
Oh, okay.
And the person that I'm working with is like so into the description field. So every time I create a field, it's like, write a description. And he's like, that was the first thing I learned, because it just leaves the org in a better place. But like,
it does. I'm gonna file a code review for that.
Yeah, and like some of the names of things just don't make any sense. And then when you look at the API name, it's completely different to the field name, and it's like it's such a mess. And we're such a small org that I can only imagine when you get into the bigger scale of things, it's like, well, what was this person thinking?
So, and when you talk about names, and especially API names, right? Like, I joke when like it fills me with anxiety, because like once you pick that API name, you kind of stuck with,
yeah.
Right? especially if code starts to tie into it. But there's an old, maybe the only computer science joke, that the two hardest things to do in computer science, or the only two hard things to do, are cache invalidation and naming things.
Yeah,
because if you get the name wrong, it starts to become so. So I talk a lot about clean code and how much these little things matter. It starts to be really, really hard for the person that came after you. I guess I get picky about, like, don't call that, you know, that variable M, right? Use it should be manager or something. So ever the person should be like, I know clearly that that's about a manager.
Sure.
But yeah, naming stuff is tough.
How, what about though? Like, so obviously everyone sets off with the right intentions. No one mm-hmm. starts their career as someone that wants to cut corners.
Yep.
So does there become a pressure to cut corners as time scales get tighter? Like writing, like, you know, fudging test classes mm-hmm. just to meet the requirements, like stuff like that. Does that, is that something that, you know, all of a sudden starts creeping into someone's work, or is it just a way of, you know, I'm just not going to let that happen?
So I think there's actually a balance there. So, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, all of us, right? Like if you're anywhere in this industry working on, I mean, you're under time pressure, right? There's a deadline and the stakeholders are expecting this, you know, this goes live on Wednesday or something. So, and I don't know, it might be from one of Bob Martin's books. So there is, I think it's what I'll call like good enough software, right? Like this isn't, it's not a masterpiece. It's not like if I had all the time in the world, but it's good enough. That said, I'm going to say there are certain like engineering fundamentals, and I'm going to go back to like write how you write your tests. To me, that's a huge one that you just don't violate, and you have a professional responsibility. I think once in a while to draw a line. There's I'm using from Bob Martin's book Clean Code, where he talks about if you were a surgeon and your patient said, I don't have time to wait for you to wash your hands, right? Let's come on, let's go and let's get started on this. And it's like, no, you know, they're the patient. They're writing your check, but you have a professional responsibility at that point to say, yes, it could be faster, but I'm going to wash my hands.
Yeah.
So I think there are certain just, I'm going to say like this fundamentals of writing good code that I do think you have to say like, yeah, we're going to miss, if that's, you know, yeah, we're going to miss the deadline by a day, but this is how we have to do it. But if there are, wow, you know what, I could make, if I refactored all this, I could shave half a second of CPU time off something. No, at that point, it's good enough shipping.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So there's balance.
Yeah, I think the one big thing I always hear about and I see posts about all the time is test classes and people just rushing them, fudging them, getting around the requirements, and it must be embarrassing when someone sees that in the future. And like, even if you don't get called out about it, like if someone doesn't post about it or say, you know, you did it, right? You know that someone one day is going to look at that and go, what were they thinking?
You know, you did it. So, and this is, I'm fanatical about tests. I guess that's my thing. Bad tests will suffocate, I think, an org faster than anything else. Because I would say if you write good tests, you can make changes very quickly and be confident that the changes you made didn't break existing functionality. If you have fudged all your tests, and especially if you only wrote tests with the goal of getting code coverage, which I realize we have to have code coverage, but it should be a byproduct of good testing, not the reason you wrote your tests. If your tests are bad, it starts to become very, very hard to make any change because you just don't know if you broke any existing features. So that's, and it's not just Salesforce development, but good tests to me are just, you know, that's a first-class development consideration. It's not an afterthought. It's not something you do later. I try to encourage, although sometimes I come up short myself, but to do, you know, test-driven development where you write the tests first and then start to write the actual code. But yeah, that's, and I know the question wasn't really about tests.
Because that's, I guess, the big thing that I hear about is the tests. And like I was told by like someone I would class as a very good developer that you should be spending as much time on your tests as the actual code you're writing. But yeah, it's like, I don't know what the actual thing is. It's like 1+1, all that stuff. And like, I've never seen that. I've heard about it a lot, but it's like, what are you achieving by doing that and leaving that in an org that people are going to see just seems absolutely criminal. Yeah.
Where that comes about, again, is time pressure. People, all of a sudden it came to be deployment day and it was like, oh my God, we don't have enough code coverage to deploy this big feature, which you should have known about, honestly, ahead of time. So yeah, now we're going to do just one of these criminal hack job, you know, I++ 1,000 times just to game the code coverage number. And I know Salesforce hates it too, because it screws with when they run their hammer tests, and they know you're doing it.
Yeah.
I think somebody said, if you call and ask for, I forgot what the limit is, 2 million characters or something. And if you call and say, we need more, and you have those sorts of tests in your org, they'll deny you for it. I've been told, never made that call. 2 million characters is a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing I've seen with yourself over the last couple of years on LinkedIn and what you share is that you aren't just learning Salesforce, right? You want to know more than what's just in the role of a Salesforce developer. Why is that important to you?
Couple of reasons. And one, I think it makes you, I mean, this industry's been very good to me, but I think, say, if you're learning Python or C or any other language, it just broadens your skill set. It makes you better at what you are doing. I joke like, I am far from a C expert, but the little bit I've started to like, because it's such a low level language, that was, you know, I think, so I'll give it like, I think for a lot of developers, one of the first errors they will encounter when they're learning to code, and they'll get a null pointer error. I must have caused 100 of those before I really actually understood from, you know, like a language like C, like really what was a pointer? You know, what did this even mean? So it makes you better at your primary focus. And I think also it's just a little bit of career insurance. I mean, right, we're all here, right? I mean, in a, you know, a free market economy is the reason Salesforce is so successful. But that doesn't mean, I don't know, 5-10 years from now, somebody has vanquished Salesforce, right? And, you know, Apex is a proprietary language. It's not, you can't, so if Salesforce is, you know, disrupted someday, like, what I like, I'm old enough now that I say, there's enough legacy stuff out there to probably keep me going for the rest of my working life. But it's, it gives you other things to do. And I guess, honestly, one, I think it's fun, it's interesting, and sometimes it's very, to me anyway, it can be very nice and liberating to do development that doesn't need the Salesforce platform, right? Like all I need is just to download Java or Python and a laptop and I can build stuff. I don't need all of the, you know, there's no local version of Apex, right? You can't just write an Apex code on your machine and run it. You need an org and you need all of the things that Salesforce has so, you know, successfully provided to customers. But it's nice to sometimes do development and not need that too. So I guess a lot of reasons out there to broaden your skill set.
Sure. And what about JavaScript? How have you found kind of the new web component framework or everything that's kind of coming in and broadening the role of a Salesforce developer?
So I think it's fantastic. And I say that as somebody that always ends up as the backend guy on every project. Like I always am trying to like, can I do this so I can have some more room? But I always end up building some framework on the backend. So what I really love about Lightning Web Components, and I say this as somebody that I consider myself a very average JavaScript developer on my very best day, that it's the first time Salesforce really did something that was, we just use JavaScript, right? Everything else was always kind of like Apex, right? Like, well, it's like Java, but it's Salesforce's Java, or, you know, Visual Force, or even Aura, right? Was kind of like, it's our strange JavaScript framework. This was the first time, right? You just worked with a language that was out there for everybody. So I think it's fantastic. I think it opens up, especially on the front end, a lot of opportunities for people working elsewhere, you know, that you could just go get a good JavaScript developer. And I think they can get up to speed on web components very, very quickly. And if you're a Salesforce person, it lets you, broaden your skill set to go things that maybe are not as Salesforce dependent. For whatever reason, I keep finding myself more interested in Python these days, which probably I don't see a lot of jobs out there for Salesforce and Python, but who knows? Maybe that'll change someday. Yeah. Or, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
Yeah. Nice. So you record videos. You have your own YouTube channel. Why did you get into that? And why is it important for you to continue doing that?
So that's why do I keep doing it? Because nobody watches those things. So. Probably, if you're going to be completely honest, I mean, I think you have your altruistic motives and your self-interest too. Is I did think at this point there were things that, as somebody that had, I'm going to say, did this like the hardest way possible, that somehow got into this industry and like still convinces people to pay me every month with no background. I mean, I think I have a pretty good idea of everything that was so confusing to me. I remember when somebody said, like, the first time I heard the word loop, I didn't know what a loop was. So I thought that was a space I could work in to try to help people that, like, I understand where these hurdles are if this is how you're trying to learn this. I also thought there was stuff that I think is very, I'm trying to make a lot of, or starting a series on, I just finished up some object-oriented programming stuff, and I'll probably be doing kind of all the classic object-oriented design patterns into 2021. There's stuff that I think is really, really useful for developers at large, not just Salesforce, but I think there's not a lot of examples of how to do it in sales. There's a lot of stuff out there now teaching you how to, kind of do that first hello world. But I think there's not a lot out there teaching intermediate to advanced development. So I guess I realized, like, there's a lot of things I think you should know to be a good developer that I say, like, they're not covered on PD1. They're not covered on PD2. They're not on Trailhead, but you need to know them. So I thought, one, this is something where, I can help the industry. It makes me better, right? Because now I have to really sit down and try to explain it and teach it to other people. And, obviously, I said, like, I'd be totally lying if I said, hey, there's no, self-interest in this. And, like all of us, right, hopefully it gets me, more recognition in the industry as, somebody that has got, some idea of what they're talking about. So, but primarily it was, I thought I could help.
Sure. Yeah, nice. Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's definitely a valid point as well around explaining things makes you a better developer, right? That's a great way to continue learning by having to explain it to someone else.
Yeah, that was a big part is, and I like teaching, I like training. Those are things I always thought I was kind of good at. Anyway, I did a lot of that in the military. And then I thought, well, there's enough, but there didn't seem to be yet a lot of stuff out there doing like computer science type topics in Apex, right? Like explaining, like, this is how recursion works, or this is how, how you do an abstract factory pattern. So I also thought there was just a need out there in the kind of the larger industry to have a place where you could go and reference that kind of stuff.
Yeah, nice. So if someone's listening or watching this and they're looking to start a developer career, what would be the biggest or best tip that you would give to someone that's at the beginning of their journey?
Stick with it. Do the 100 Days of Code Challenge. Do it with Salesforce. Do it with Apex. Truly, I think, I'm not kidding when I say, like, so everybody, so going back to earlier, I talked about, like, there's levels of ability, right? And you hear within development, somebody's a 10X engineer. Okay. Most of us will never be 10X engineers. I'm not a 10X engineer. There's a ton of jobs out there for 1X. Like, you are just a normally productive programmer, right? And I think pretty much anybody can become a 1X engineer. I did it, but it takes work. It's hard. I say it's harder than you realize. And I guess that goes back to, like, learning a language or anything else. You do day one and you're like, oh, this seems easy. I got it. But you don't. So do it every day. If you really want to do this, do it every day. Honestly, try to do it an hour a day for 6 months, because you're just developing a whole new set of skills. You're exposing yourself to new patterns. There's common ways to solve problems that the first time I saw it somewhere, I was like, oh, never would have thought of that, right? But now I've seen it, I've done it 1,000 times, I don't even think about it. So I guess that would be my advice. Is it takes time. It is definitely a marathon. This is not something you're going to learn to do over a weekend. Like, I thought, like, oh, I'll just do this beginner developer Trailhead trail, and I'll be making big bucks in a couple of weeks. It takes time and perseverance. And unlike me, try to find some people to talk to that can look at your code and help make you a little bit better.
Yeah, nice. So I'm interested to hear this next final question. What does the future look like for you in terms of your career path? Like, what do you hope to achieve with Salesforce or even outside of the Salesforce ecosystem?
So that's an awesome question, Ben. And I think about it quite a bit. And going back, because I know you post a lot on LinkedIn about architects and what is an architect, and everybody, and I think this is actually your post a while back, that, like, everybody wants to be an architect, but, like, in every other development industry, like, I feel like you could just be a senior developer for forever, yeah, right? The scope of your responsibilities may grow. So all that is to say, so I think there's a lot in this industry in particular that, like, if you're not on the way to CTA, you're not trying very hard. You don't take your career very seriously. And I guess maybe now I kind of push back against that, because I think there really has to be room for just expert developers, right? Just like master engineers that can work in JavaScript and Python and Java. And there's fantastic people out there that are doing that kind of work, like, you know, like Scott Wells, right? The guy that, you know, did Illuminated Cloud. And so I guess that is to say, maybe someday Salesforce will have another certificate, right? For just, I don't know, PD3 or something. But there's so, I think I take my career seriously. I'm not really like, maybe I'll do CTA someday. I'll probably do system architect, but I'm much more interested in just seeing how good I can get as a programmer.
Which,
so
that's what I was expecting to hear, and also what I wanted to hear, because I think that's really refreshing, and I think more people need to talk like that. Like, some of the very, very best engineers I know have no aspirations of being a CTA. Like, an amazing developer I know that comes from more of a JavaScript background, I asked him, mm-hmm. he's been working in Salesforce for a few years, and I asked him if he was going to get the JavaScript certification, and his response was, why would I want to be certified by people that thought Aura was a good idea?
I hate Aura.
So does he, right? But like, I think that's so true in what you said, that you don't have to be an architect. You can be an amazing, amazing engineer. Yeah. And being an amazing engineer is a career, like, and progressing. Because I guess people see that, oh, I'm now a senior engineer. Where do I go from here? But in a lot of companies, like, the senior engineers keep getting pay rises. They keep learning new things. Yeah. And although their job title isn't changing, they're taking on more responsibility. Like, architecture might be part of their job, but they don't have to have that architect title. Yeah.
And I guess, yeah, I sometimes feel like I still don't, to this day, like, really know what an architect does. and I don't know, like, the other day, another developer had a question. I was like, oh, okay, well, this looks like a great place, you know, for a strategy pattern, and you should encapsulate this and, you know, move it into its own class. And I was like, I don't know, maybe that's being an architect. I don't know, but I wouldn't know how to do that if I wasn't studying programming.
Sure.
So
yeah, like,
that's it. You know, who knows? We'll see what happens, but I'm pretty happy coding.
Yeah, nice. I want to make sure people understand that I really do think the CTA is great, and people that go down that path, absolutely, like, it's an amazing achievement. And I've interviewed so many of them, and they're incredible mm-hmm. people. All of them have this thirst for learning and have achieved massive things, but it's not for everyone, and you don't have to go down that path. That's the kind of point I want to make. Like, you can be a really good engineer and still have amazing success in your career. You don't have to be an architect.
Yeah, no, I agree. And there's, you know, there's plenty of great salaries out there for, you know, really, really skilled developers. It's something I think I'd like to see more of in the industry, is just a kind of a realization that there's lots of paths that you can focus on being the very best at. Like, it's possible to not become a CTA and still have taken your career very seriously.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, absolutely. So I'm glad we're on the same page with that. So if anyone wants to hit you up or watch your videos, or where can they find you online?
Well, obviously, you can always find me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active there. And I have a YouTube channel.
Well, hopefully we can send people across, because I think there's a lot of value there. So thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the chat. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you be the best engineer that you can be in the years to come, and keep kicking those goals.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talent Hub Talk. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and also leave a short review. We're keen for this podcast to reach as many people in the Salesforce ecosystem as possible, and your reviews will help us do that.